about the supernova legacy survey and sort of the status of the experiment and the results that we have towards trying to measure and understand the dark energy. So the basic goal of SNLS is trying to figure out what is dark energy, or more realistically, to just take the first baby steps towards, you know, beginning to understand what it might be. I'm sure I don't really need to remind this audience that the discovery that the universe is accelerating due to some form of dark energy puts us in a bit of a theoretical quandary. Because while we do have a, you know, fairly obvious explanation, Einstein's cosmological constant, it's not satisfying in a lot of ways. And it introduces its own problems, such as why would the universe just happen to be accelerating now when we have the technology to observe it? This perhaps unsurprisingly has led to the introduction or the proposal of a large number of alternative explanations for what might be causing the acceleration of the universe. But an important thing to realize is that, at least as of right now, we really don't have any evidence to differentiate between them, other than perhaps Occam's razor. As Rich Muller liked to say, in some sense, the discovery of dark energy is the biggest discovery you can ever have, because you discovered more than half of the universe, which is maybe overstating things slightly. But I do think that, it's sort of hard to claim that we have a really great understanding of the universe if more than half of it is so mysterious. So the way that we do this, which is pretty standard, is by mapping out the expansion history of the universe. And the thing that we're really sort of after is W here, which is the equation of state of dark energy. And as a quick and obvious reminder, if W was 1/3, dark energy would be just like radiation. If it was 0, it would be just like matter. And if it's -1, then it's the plain, boring old cosmological constant. So the first step towards trying to see whether or not we need a more complicated theory is to try and measure W and see if it's not -1. If it's not -1, that's really exciting, and that's what we all sort of really want. The next thing you can do after that is to try and see whether or not W is changing. Both of these are very difficult measurements. We've discovered that the universe is accelerating. Now we want to understand why. The tool for this, there are lots of different tools out there, which I think various people have talked about or will talk about. But sort of the most established old technique for looking at dark energy is to use type 1a supernova. So here are sort of two picturesque nearby examples. And the reason for that is that they're really, really bright. So you can see them relatively far away. They're about as bright as the galaxy that they occur in. And the really important thing, though, is that they're empirically pretty good standard candles. They're all pretty much the same. Although it turns out that if you sort of measure them, make a couple more measurements, you can make them better, better standard candles, which is sort of a big bonus. But despite this, despite the fact that these are a reasonably well-established tool for this, it's worth always remembering that there are a lot of things we really just don't know about type 1a supernova. So we're pretty sure that a type 1a supernova is what happens when you have a white dwarf that gets too heavy and blows up. Basically, at the pretty close to the Chandrasekhar mass, not quite. But the problem is while that seems pretty clear, we don't actually know how to make a white dwarf that's really that massive. Just to sort of schematically go over this, you start out with two stars. You pretty much have to have a binary system. One of them turns into a white dwarf. And then either one of two things could happen. You could get two white dwarfs that then gravitationally radiate and spiral into each other and blow up. Or you could have the second star, reaches the end of its main sequence, gets really, really big, dumps a bunch of material, and then you blow up. The problem is that in detail, neither of these works. Or alternatively, the problem is in detail, both of these work. There's enough uncertainty in the theoretical predictions that you can't really tell what the mechanism is. And so this is something you should always keep in the back of your mind when you think about type 1a stuff, is there's a lot of things we don't know, so it's really important that whatever experiment you're doing, you're trying to test how well they work, as well as just using them to measure something. So enter the supernova legacy survey. This is currently the largest supernova survey in existence. It's a huge amount of imaging on the CFHT telescope, about 200 nights spread over 5 years, in order to find type 1a supernova and follow them, et cetera. We've always made all of our supernova candidates available to anybody who wanted them immediately, although there aren't really that many people who have the observational resources lying around to actually go observe them, sadly. Because there are other things that go bump in the night besides 1A supernova, particularly other types of supernova, we also have to take spectra in order to make sure that it's the right type of supernova. And SNLS uses an enormous amount of spectroscopy, actually more time taking spectra than taking images. And sort of at the end, we have probably on the order of 1 to 2,000 supernova that we've discovered. Although, unfortunately, we can't use all of them. The number that I'm finally going to show you on the Hubble diagram is a lot smaller than that because you have to be able to get the spectra. But these are sort of the number of candidates that we have that are probably 1As. And if someday somebody figures out a really good way of making sure that something is a type 1A supernova that doesn't involve taking a spectra, you should be able to go back and harvest a lot of these. So this is CFHT in the background. This is Gemini, another telescope that we use. For astronomy, SNLS is, you know, a big experiment. You know, this is big science. This is a lot of people. I suppose if you come from like an LHC background or something, this is a, you know, medium-sized working group or something like that. But the primary efforts are in Canada and in France, although there are active people in Oxford, some people in NWL in the US, et cetera. And it uses, as I said, a lot of the world's large optical telescopes. So this is, you know, has used quite a bit of observing resources. The important aspects of SNLS that sort of make it really good at what it does is that we've used one telescope to do everything. Sort of previous experiments used a lot of different telescopes, so they could never entirely understand their instruments perfectly because they had a lot of them to deal with. We have one instrument, so we can spend a lot of effort trying to understand it really, really well. The data set that we're getting is both larger, many more supernova, and substantially higher quality per supernova than sort of previous high redshift supernova work, which is, you know, what drew me to Canada to work on this is, you know, bigger and better, so it seemed like a good thing to work with. And as I said, an important part about this is because the quality is high, you can do a lot of tests to make sure that things are actually working. Particularly the thing that makes CFHT possible, or the legacy survey possible, is this new camera called Megacam. It had a nice run for about 5 or 6 years being the largest camera in the world on a telescope, which is no longer the case. But it looks at a piece of sky about 4 times the size of the full moon. This is what it actually looks like. To give you some idea of what that does for you, this is one of our 4 fields. We have 4 fields that we can observe year round. And most of the stuff you can see here are stars, and maybe sort of one galaxy there. But that's just because this is a big field of view, and you're seeing only the nearby really bright things. If you sort of take a small piece of the field and you zoom in, you see that almost everything that's actually in the image are galaxies, which gives us lots and lots of places to look for supernova. And so in one image, you see a lot of supernova at one time, and that's very useful. This is actually only about half resolution, but I don't know. I could keep zooming in. So this is, you know, a little movie of one of our supernova. What we're actually trying to do, the data that we actually get is called the light curve, which is, you know, the supernova gets brighter and then it fades away. So if you want to do science with this, if you want to use this as a standard candle, you need to measure a couple things. One of them is you need to measure some sort of representative brightness. That's your standard candle. But like I said, you can actually make them better by measuring a few other things, like the shape of the light curve, because it turns out for sort of empirical reasons, and now which is sort of backed up by theory, that there's a relationship between how bright they are and how fat the light curve is. And you want to measure the color, which is really important. And what that means to an astronomer is you want to measure the supernova at more than one wavelength. And by comparing those two wavelengths, you form what's called the color. And that tells you interesting things about the supernova. Among other things, we expect that there should be dust, because we see dust everywhere else that we look. And dust makes things dimmer and redder. So it's really good if you can correct for that. As I said, we find and follow many different supernova at the same time. So this is just sort of a sampling of that. This is sort of at one time. You can see we're following many supernova simultaneously, which is great if you have the telescope time to back it up, which we do. One of the other really important features of SNLS is that we use 4 filters. We look at 4 different wavelengths. When we do our project. And the reason why this is important is that I have a little movie here to try and explain this, which is maybe a little bit too busy. But one of the important things about doing supernova work is that this is a relative measurement. What you're doing is you're comparing distant supernova to nearby supernova. And the nearby supernova don't come from us, sort of for practical reasons. And so what you have to do is you have to be able to take the supernova that you observe at some other redshift and compare it with ones that were, you know, that are basically in the local universe. And all the local ones are basically observed in, you know, these filters, these pass bands, U, sort of the smooth ones, U, B, and V. And then this wiggly line here is sort of what the spectrum of a typical 1A looks like. And then we actually observe in, you know, these filters, G, R, I, and Z. And the point is you want to make sure that you actually have a good match to the low redshift observations, that you sort of cover the same range in wavelength space, et cetera, so that your job is much easier. And what this movie will show is it'll show as the redshift increases, you'll see how the different filters sort of line up with the nearby sample at different redshifts. And you can see right here, this is sort of color green, this is sort of color green, these sort of match, B and G. And then V doesn't really match very well with R, but it's the closest thing. But of course, we don't actually observe anything at redshift zero. But if you, you know, run the movie, you can see that now B is sort of matching with R, then B is sort of matching with I, and then B is, you know, eventually B starts to match with the Z band out here. And what that shows you, it's supposed to show you anyways, is that we actually measure colors at all redshifts. In fact, at most of them, we actually have more than one color. We've looked at, you know, at least three wavelengths simultaneously, and that allows us to do a lot of internal tests on our data, which is, you know, very nice. And a lot of other, most previous experiments have not generally had this. They've had, like, two wavelengths that they look at. So the state of play of SNLS is we put out a paper in 2006, which I think was pretty well received. That was, you know, the first year result. SNLS is actually ending in about 7 days. That will be 5 years of data. We are working on the third year analysis, not the fifth year analysis, because it takes a lot of time to process through everything. And, you know, right after I come to the finish with this meeting, I'm going to be going to Oxford to, we're having a collaboration meeting where we're hoping to, you know, push these papers out the door. So our sample has gotten quite a bit better over this process, but unfortunately, I said there's this comparative measurement where you're comparing with nearby supernova. That hasn't changed very much since 2006, which is really sort of a limiting factor for us. So what's new? More supernova. You know, go from 71 SNLS to about 250. That's a big step forward. One of the nice things about that is it's actually big enough that you can start looking at subsamples, like supernova and particular types of galaxies and stuff like that. And it's actually big enough that those subsamples are meaningful. A big deal is that we've made substantial improvements in our calibration compared with the first year results, which has been a very difficult task. We've also been using our own data to improve our empirical models of supernova, which has made them better standard candles, which means we're making better use of the data that we do get, which is very nice. In particular, we've been using near UV data, which is not really accessible for ground-based nearby supernova. But the thing that's really probably should really set us apart from the first year analysis is we're going to have a much, much better handling and characterization of our systematic errors, which are really sort of becoming extremely important in the supernova cosmology game. And it'll be much better than anything that has been done before. So to show you what this means, though, this is the first year results in terms of W. Remember, minus one is plain old boring lambda. These were the first year results, sort of preliminary results for where we are right now. You can see that it has, you know, improved substantially by adding that many more supernova. But, you know, usually you don't just want to look at supernova results by themselves because they're good at constraining one direction and not very good at constraining the other direction. So you combine with other things like WMAP or baryon acoustic oscillations, neither of which gives you very good constraints on W. But when you put them all together, you get a pretty good error, which, as you can see, is at the moment quite consistent with the cosmological constant, which is perhaps sort of sad. But yeah, you don't get to choose the way the universe is, I guess. This is the Hubble diagram. I'm not going to talk about this much. You can sort of see what it looks like. There are these outlier points that are rejected. They were not rejected for being outliers on this. They were rejected for other reasons. And then they turned out to be outliers on this too, which was very encouraging. This is how you actually estimate cosmological parameters, by looking at brightness versus redshift. You can also do things like relax the assumption of flatness. You still see it looks like it's still basically consistent with a cosmological constant. We have not yet really tried to look at the change in W with redshift. That's really hard. And we'll probably, to really do that, you really need the next generation of experiments. So as I said, systematics are becoming sort of a big deal, or are a very big deal. Some of them are sort of more fun than others. Some of them are more physics related, more supernova physics related. Some of them, like calibration, or you don't really learn that much about supernova physics by studying the calibration of your detector. But of course, you're not, you know, how interesting something is doesn't determine how important it is. So you have to spend a lot of time on things that are not supernova physics. But, you know, to sort of show you what this does, this is the result, the statistics result. When you fold in sort of our current estimate of the systematic errors, you can see that, you know, it degrades the result considerably. And this has sort of always been here in all the previous results. It's just generally not shown. But, you know, the goal of SNLS is to sort of get, try and measure W to on the order of 10%, including systematics. And in fact, we have achieved that once you fold in like WMAP. We're actually slightly better than that at the moment, and are hoping to do, you know, better still. This is a too busy slide. You're not actually meant to read all of this. But the point is that I'm trying to make here is, you know, SNLS is probably published at this point on the order of maybe 18 or 19 papers. Probably about 10 or 12 of them have been related to systematics. One of them was a cosmology paper. Of course, the cosmology one has more citations than all of the others put together, or will ever have. But this is actually what we spend a great deal of our time worrying about. Although, as I said, some of these are also can be called supernova physics, so perhaps they're a bit more interesting. To sort of show you what's important, you know, here's a list of various contributions to our systematic error budget. Preliminary, of course, as I said, the final result right now is about 9%. But one of the lessons that we've really learned from doing this is that we sort of expected that the statistical error was going to be limited by the nearby supernova sample. And that, of course, is pretty much true. But what's also true is actually the systematic error is also limited by the nearby sample. And these are some of the ones that we could expect to get a lot better if we could replace the nearby supernova sample. And that should happen probably within the next year or two, because there are various other projects out there that are trying to do that. And so these are probably going to get a lot better, which will, of course, leave other things, which will then become dominant. But even if we don't necessarily do anything, our results should actually get quite a bit better, sort of in the next year to two timescale. In some sense, this is sort of, you know, bad luck, which is that we got there first. If the other groups had gotten there ahead of us, they would be the ones complaining that, you know, things didn't get as much better as they had hoped because the stupid high redshift sample wasn't very good. But here we are. Okay, so to go talk about some of them in slightly more detail. For example, like I said, a really big part of what we've been worried about is calibrating our detector. And, you know, this has been a lot of work, primarily led by Nicolas Regnault in France, it's been a long slog. For example, he discovered using our data that the band pass of our detector was not constant as a function of position. And it was, you know, supposed to be more constant than that. He found this in our array. And then we talked to CFHT about it, and they went back and said, oh, you know, we actually have these scans where we did this test, but we didn't, you know, show them to you. And then they looked at them, and they matched what he had discovered pretty much exactly, which was, you know, pretty impressive, I thought. But at this point, we think we pretty much solved most of the problems about taking our data and tying it onto a standard astronomical calibration, which we need to do to compare to the nearby supernova sample. The problem is what we're really running into now is that, so, you know, so you're tied to this standard astronomical calibration. What does that mean? What is the meaning of that calibration? And it turns out that's not so well understood as one would like. And that's proved very difficult. That's probably been a major part of the holdup. And our results is trying to understand what in the world does it mean to be on the Landolt system. You know what that means. OK, here's something that's a little bit more supernova physics. So supernova theory turns out to be really, really hard. Hard to the point where it doesn't really make definite predictions that you can necessarily go out and test, because different theorists will tell you that exactly the opposite happens in a given situation. But one thing that it does do, or that it is extremely useful for, is it tells you interesting places to look. And one of the conclusions of supernova theory in the past couple, you know, I don't know, past 5, 6 years, I guess, has been that a really interesting place to look for supernova evolution or something weird going on with supernova is in the near UV, which is sort of short word of this. Now, the problem is that the atmosphere stops you from looking at that in that wavelength range for nearby supernova from the ground. Even with the sorry state of our ozone layer, we still can't see into the UV. So you have two choices. You can either go to space, which is a great solution, and people were doing that before HST broke, or you can take high redshift supernova, and you can observe them because they're redshifted, so it's not blocked by the atmosphere. And so we had a particular program led by Richard Ellis to actually take very high quality spectra, this is spectra of our supernova, to look at the UV. And what's shown here is, you know, splitting the sample by redshift, and you can see they're basically identical. In fact, I think Richard was pretty disappointed in this. He was hoping for something a lot more, much stronger sign of something going on or something more crazy. But type 1a supernova seemed to be quite homogeneous here in the near UV, more so than perhaps one might have expected. In fact, enough more homogeneous that it presents some challenges for the people who are predicting there should be something here. One of the things we've been doing, which I'm just going to sort of go over quickly, is use our own data. Because I said we can measure the near UV in our data that you can't do with ground-based low-redshift data. If we build our supernova model to include our data, to incorporate that, we can extend our model towards the blue. We can use more of our data. That makes our supernovas better standard candles, which is a great win. There's also our version that we developed in Toronto is called SIFTO. The version that has been developed in France is called SALT. For those of you who aren't Canadian, SIFTO is a, quote, smoother running brand of Canadian table salt, which was a, I don't know, weak shot at them, I guess. You can see that as a result of improving this, you can see that type 1a supernova are pretty homogeneous. This is our sample plotted at a bunch of different wavelengths. And you almost can't even really see this, but the red points are the high redshift data and the blue points are the low redshift data. And it's actually almost sort of disturbing how homogeneous these are. I already said something about going blue. The point was going to be is that at a redshift of 0.75, here's the U-band filter. This is the furthest you could ever make your model if you were looking only at low redshift data. But you can see there's actually quite a bit of signal still bluer than that. And in fact, when you look at a supernova at this redshift, you see plenty of signal. So if you don't make your model go there by using our data, you just have to throw this out, which is not a good thing. One of the major outstanding issues we've been worrying about is what supernova colors mean. As I've alluded to before, we expect that redder supernovas should be fainter because of dust. And we sort of have some idea how dust behaves. And so we want to correct for that because it makes supernova much better and it removes some biases. The problem is if you actually look in detail and you say, OK, how do actual 1A in the wild behave? They don't behave like it's dust. They behave like maybe it's dust plus something else. So this is a color plot, which shows basically the UV color versus the optical color of type 1a supernova. And there's a fairly clear relationship with a fair amount of scatter. And this is just a measurement of how it is that, if a supernova gets bluer in the UV, how much bluer does it get in the optical? And what you can see is there's sort of a clearly defined with scatter locus and then some sort of outliers. But the problem is that if you look at what dust should do this, which is a lot steeper than what you actually observe. So whatever's going on, it's not dominated by dust. And lots of people have been running around assuming that it is dust. It's clearly not. But if you look at these outlier populations, you sort of maybe consider that a picture that might explain this is you have this locus of most supernova don't really have a lot of dust. They're dominated by something inherent to the supernova themselves. But then there's some population that does have a lot of dust, and those are kicked off of the relationship in that direction. But this is something that right now does place some systematic limits on how well we can measure things. And it's the sort of thing that will require some improved understanding to make better. You can't just keep doing what you're doing and make it go away. So I think right now this is not limiting. But I think with sort of future experiments, which are going to beat down most of the other errors a lot, this is a place where they really have to pay some attention. Among other things, assuming that it's dust led to the claim that there was a local change in the Hubble constant, the so-called Hubble bubble, about 2 years ago, where it turns out if you sort of drop the assumption that the reddening has to be strictly due to dust, the Hubble bubble goes away. So this bump here is the Hubble bubble. This is not the Hubble bubble. So you can get yourself into all sorts of trouble by making that assumption. OK, so I haven't don't have time to talk about all the science we're doing with SNLS. I just sort of tried to focus on the cosmology. One of the other major projects, though, has been trying to measure rates of supernova. This is really aimed at trying to understand where supernova come from, what the progenitors are, like looking at what types of supernova occur in a galaxy with what type of stellar population that presumably is making the supernova. Also tried to do cosmology with other types of supernova, core collapse supernova. We really want to, this SNLS is pretty much almost has to be the last major survey that is mostly defined by having spectra of all of its objects, because spectra are just too expensive to do. And if you step up to LSST or something like that and you have 50,000 supernova, there's just no way you can get spectra. And so in order to use that data, you have to have a really good way of telling that something is a 1A just based on photometry with no spectra. And you have to have a really good handle on what the errors in that process are. As I said, it seems quite obvious to us that the third-year sample is going to be a major step forward in terms of how things are handled, how the systematics are handled, things like that. But the potential is really going to be realized when these nearby supernova samples, like the Sloan supernova sample or the Carnegie supernova project for KATE or the CFA supernova program, release stuff in the next year or two. We, of course, want to make all of this stuff, the plan is to make all this stuff available so that people can try their own, theory for W. In principle, by making a Cosmo MC plugin that actually handles supernova correctly. But we also are also really looking forward to using our data to look at a lot more supernova physics once we've sort of finished with the cosmological analysis. So the lessons are, I'm basically out of time, I think, are that A, we need a better low redshift sample. B, calibration is actually pretty difficult. Really, in order to make good use of supernova data, you need high-quality data, not just more data. If somebody were to say to me that you could have a larger supernova sample just like SNLS, that would be useful. But if somebody were to say, I'm going to give you a much larger sample, but it's lower quality, I wouldn't be interested in working on that. In order to really be able to understand what's going on with supernova, you need better data than you just need to do cosmology. Okay, that is it.
Questions?
So 2 years ago, there was this sensational, for my taste at least, the claim of Super Chandrasekhar supernova. So 2 years after the fact, does the claim still stand? Or
yes.
It could be a misclassified supernova by any chance?
Catch the last part. But yes, the claim still stands. That was discovered in our data. Evidence for a supernova, that there were a couple lines of evidence that there was a supernova that was more than Chandrasekhar mass, which is maybe not supposed to happen, although it's not clear. That has stood the test of time. Furthermore, there has now been a nearby supernova that has also been observed that has sort of the same signatures. And of course, it's a nearby supernova, so the quality of the data is much higher. They have many spectra, et cetera. On the other hand, both of them are very obviously weird, right? What we would be very interested in finding would be something that was sort of in between these really weird ones and the normal ones, because then that would, imply that there was some continuum of properties. Whereas as of right now, these are just real oddballs that stand out like a mile.
Are there any astrophysical sort of ideas how that?
Yeah, there are a couple ideas. You can either do it by rotating the white dwarf. The details are not really in place. Or, of course, there's always the traditional, I don't know what's going on, I'm going to blame magnetic fields response, which, works. But, people have not entirely explained this. But those are sort of the two obvious ideas.
Yeah. What is the highest redshift you can get up to in the survey?
This survey sort of runs out of steam slightly above redshift 1, which is really optimal for measuring W. If you want to measure the change in W with redshift, you want a slightly longer redshift baseline, like the Adam Riess's HSD program. It's very useful for that.
Okay, more questions? Okay, thank you very much. Yep.